This is the Sunday afternoon meeting. Round Robin at Odessa, Texas, February the 4th, 1968. Charles D. is the MC. Dick Welb of Van Nuys, California is the speaker. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Odessa, Round Robin of Alcoholics Anonymous. Shall we open this meeting with a moment of silent prayer or meditation? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. At this time, I'd like to call on the Reverend W.C. Strickland, minister of Asbury Methodist Church here in Odessa, for the invocation. Good.
Oh God, we've come apart again to admit to ourselves and to you that we cannot live life fully without you and without each other. Given to us the assurance deep within each of us that with thy help and with the help of the people around us, both in this organization and throughout the world, we can have meaningful lives. And Father, help us to show to the world that this is exactly what they're looking for, a life that matters. Today, as we again come before you to hear this one who shall tell of his experience, we seek your guidance for him. We pray that our ears and our eyes and our hearts might be opened, that we might let the inspiration of this moment be carried out in being better men and women and boys and girls, young people, for you. Thank you for the feelings that we have within us right now, that you're there and that you're on our side. In the love and in the spirit that we know from you, we ask this our prayer. Amen.
My name is Charlie D., and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Through God's grace in showing me a way to live through the Alcoholics Anonymous program, I haven't found it necessary to use any form of brain deadeners since the 3rd of July of 1964. The 3rd of July is an interesting time to stop drinking. That weekend never got off the ground. The most recent meeting of the group I call home was Friday night at the Suburban Group here in Odessa. It's an open meeting. We had guest speakers. They were members of Alateen. The chairman of this meeting was my daughter. The wind-up speaker of this meeting was my son. If you don't think it takes guts to stay in town after that. Have you ever heard your fourth step read out loud in public? I'm only kidding. It's only through the grace of God and having been in the Alateen program 3 and 1.5 years respectively that it wasn't read in public. But in order to tell their stories, it was necessary to brush against mine. Contrary to what some of you may think, there are a few doors left in our house, but not very many. If anyone has any question as to my right to be here and call myself an alcoholic and a drug addict, check with someone who was at the Suburban Group Friday night. Alcoholics Anonymous is an interesting organization. There are many people here, possibly that this will be the first connection with AA. There are many visitors and guests, and truly we are delighted to have you because we like for people to know what's going on. We're very grateful that we have this group to help us in our sickness. There are a number of things that are unique about AA. The first thing we find out when we go into AA is that we were not bums, as everyone had called us and as we thought of ourselves, but that we are legitimately ill. This was a delightful thing for me to find out. They tell us alcoholism is a disease. In fact, the American Medical Association has lent its credence to it, so we can call ourselves sick. But more than that, it tells us what to do about it. All my life, when I was growing up, the one piece of advice I got most was, boy, change your attitude, or you're not going to get along in this world. I didn't change my attitude, and I didn't. I would have been delighted, but no one ever told me how until I was 36 years old and quite by accident stumbled onto the AA program because truly I didn't know what was wrong with me. Someone told me what was wrong with me and sent me to AA, and I knew I had come home the first night I walked into that meeting. It was all there. We're guided by 12 steps that tell us how to change this attitude. So truly, we are able to stop drinking. Most of us think that alcoholism is a symptom of an underlying disease, an emotional illness, a social disease, as somebody once called it, but in a little different term. These 12 steps give us a guide for living, and I am here and someone sitting beside you who is testimony to the fact that it works. Alcoholics Anonymous meets in groups. We get together, we talk to each other, we listen to other people talk, and these groups are guided by what we call 12 traditions. Well, number 7 in these traditions says every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Ray B. has a wrecking crew lined up, and they're going to pass paper sacks among you.
Who's the bag man?
The bag man's right over here. But let me point out specifically that this is for AA members and Al-Anon members, and we respectfully request that our guests decline from contributing. If you'll just put your money in the bag with no comment, let's go on with the announcements. We've been asked to make several announcements, and here they are. The Alateen group, and I brushed on this, has a meeting. Also called a round robin, Saturday, February 24th at 4:30 at the 710 Club in Midland. The speakers are Fort Worth Alateens and a junior Alateen. This is the Alateen round robin, February 24th. Other announcements from 710 include the Valentine's Dance, Saturday, February 10th. If you haven't been to a dance at 710, you have a treat in store. They're lots of fun. Sunday, February 11th, at the open meeting at 5 o'clock at 7:10, Clarence Snyder will celebrate his 30th AA birthday. It will also be dinner Sunday at the 7:10. Clarence is the fellow who wrote The Brewmeister in the big book. Another announcement from 7:10, the meeting this afternoon at 7:10 has been moved 30 minutes later. It will be 5:30 to give you plenty of time to get home without driving too fast. Woody W. from Lubbock and Tim O. from Odessa will be the speakers at 7:10. Other meetings today include a meeting of the Suburban Group here in Odessa at the usual time of 8:30. For last night's speaker, Ruth, there is a covered dish luncheon Tuesday at the Suburban Group here in Odessa from 10 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. Now, for the ladies who work, you're specifically invited to come because they'll be serving dinner at 12 and they'll get it over quickly so you can get back to your jobs. That's Tuesday from 10 till 2 at the Suburban Group, a covered dish luncheon. So you will get a chance to get to know Ruth better. We have a long distance telephone call for James and we're not sure about the last name. Some people call it Wagner. It looks more like Werner. W-H-E-O-N-E-R is the spelling. This man from Lubbock. If he's here, if you'll check for the call. Are there other announcements that need to be made? El Paso, the 23rd and the 24th. Oh, the El Paso Jamboree, the 23rd and the 24th of this month. They always have excellent speakers. Are there other groups that have announcements? We'd just be delighted for you to. Somebody on the left had his hand up. Don't see him anymore. It is so nice to have our out-of-town visitors. Most of you were recognized last night. In the interest of time, we will just welcome you. We always have such good response from our friends from out of town, and we're so happy to have you with us. We're happy, of course, to have our visitors. It's such a pleasure to be able to be here, and you didn't come to hear me. You came to hear a fellow from California, and I was sitting with him this morning in the coffee shop of the hotel, and the waitress, who is particularly vivacious, came along and said, "Gee, you look like a movie star." Maybe he is. No, not to me, Strick. If you hadn't asked, maybe I could have gotten away with it. Possibly he is. I'll let him tell you that part of his story. I asked him what to say, and he said, "Well, just say that liar from California is here again." But we find that that doesn't go too well in AA, and he'll tell you a little bit about that, too. He made a remarkable recovery, having gotten shot on I Spy just last week. He died 3 times, I believe. We're delighted to have him with us here. California's largest gun collector, Dick W. from Hollywood.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, shut up until I get through. It's my Texas sponsor down here in the front row. I have to be careful of him. I found a new sponsor when I came down here, Bill and Doris. We had quite a meeting last night after the meeting. And Ruth was just wonderful up here. Well, she would have to be because she's another Virgo. Such as I am. And, of course, the young lady chairing the meeting was also a Virgo. So you had a very clean meeting last night. How it'll turn out today, I don't know. But one state that I did not louse up while I was drinking was the state of Texas. If I'd had a little more time, I possibly would have done in Texas what I did in Florida. And put myself on the map again. Somebody asked me the other day out in California, they said, with a little worry, you know, they said, "How are you doing, Webb?" And I said, "Have you seen my picture in the paper recently?" And they said, "No." I said, "I'm doing fine." Because I was one of those types that was in a position that when I did get into trouble, I got on the front page. And I have clippings, which I get out every once in a while just to remind myself. And I took unto myself, out there on the coast, a fellow who's been in AA for 23 years, and he is one of the most hotly controversial figures on the West Coast in AA, named Larry. And Larry has been an actor for about 35 years. One of the first things that Larry told me, I was about 30 days in the program, and if many of you know Chuck Chamberlain, you know how spiritual and how fabulous he is on that side. Well, my sponsor is the other way. So you get the picture, by the way. Larry was looking at me one day and he said, "Well, you probably won't make this program." Not that I didn't have enough problems already, you know. So I said, "Why not?" He said, "Your ego's too big." He said, this is an ego program. Then he said, I guess I've worked with 200 or 300 people from show business. And he said, they don't make it. I said, but you made it. He said, but I'm different. But he's right. He is different. He is something else. But these are the people that I turned to when I came in. And I am delighted that I did. I'm aware that there are a number of newcomers here today. And I do hotly suggest that you tie yourself to someone who has been in the program a long time, who still retains that flavor of the first AA meetings, because as my sponsor pointed out to me, he said, this program was not designed for rich people. This was not designed for people with a lot of status. He said, this was designed for people who were broke and sunk and out of everything. And he said, the more you have, the more difficult it is to make this program. And I've never forgotten that. When I came to AA, I was very large in the bank account. And I had more money than I'd ever had before in my life. And I was appearing in 2 series, and I had another one offered to me. And all in 15 minutes out in my front yard, I blew the whole thing. And then since coming to AA in the last, well, since June 12, 1960, it has not been precipitously downhill, it's just been a slow downhill. I couldn't seem to get. And I would see all of my friends, a lot of these guys that come in broke. They began working right away and making money, and I'm sitting here saying, I can't understand it. So I asked Larry, I said, do you think I'll ever get back anything that I ever had? He said, maybe not. So he said, are you ready to accept the answer? And then, of course, I began to project. And when we project is when we start getting into trouble. So this program has forced me to live one day at a time. I got to the place, and probably the worst thing that you can do out there in California is to work by the day. You have no status when you work by the day. So other actors who would come into the program would call me from time to time, and they'd say, do you do day work? And I said, yeah. They said, well, with your background, how can you do that? I said, if I don't take that job, somebody else will, and I have bills to pay. Oh, Dick, I could never do that. And then I began to realize what Larry meant. Most of those guys are out drinking or insane or dead. Because it has been necessary for me. And if you identify with any of the thinking, which I try to posit when I speak, well, please do so. It's been necessary for me to be very, very careful of my thinking. When necessary, back off. I make plans. I don't know how in the hell they're going to turn out. I used to try to control these things. I wanted to do a certain thing, and that's what I was going to do. My life is unmanageable. I make the effort, and I am not responsible for the results. This I have learned, and these years in the program have taught me to pull back, pull back, pull back, pull back, regardless of what I wanted to do. And in asking Larry, I said, do you ever think I'll get any of these things back or anything? He said, maybe not. But he said, when you are ready, these things will happen for you. He knows. I don't know. He said, if that time arrives, then you will know, because he will say, now, Lazarus, now is the time. Not on my time, on his time. All right, perhaps the reason I didn't go back to work is because I couldn't handle it. When I came to the program, it was 2 years. The phone didn't ring at all, as far as work. Absolute silence. That was good for me. I didn't like it. A bit. And then the third year, they would give me a little part and then stand back to watch what was going to happen. To see what I was going to do. They're always ready to replace me. And this in face of my not ever being drunk on the set, never holding up production, I so-called got drunk on my own time. I destroyed me on my own time. To this day, I do not think that I was a drunk, because I would drink for a period of about 6 hours. I'd do 2/5 in those 6 hours. And I would shoot my guns in the house and go to bed. The thinking behind this whole thing indicates that I had a very deep, serious, emotional problem long before I ever took the first drink. I have always felt different than other people. I've always felt removed, remote from other people. And when I drank, I felt comfortable. And I could do those little things that I had in my mind. And some of them weren't very nice. Most of them weren't. And after I would get drunk and do those things, I'd sober up and I'd feel horrible remorse and guilt. But that little thing was saying, yes, but you know what you could have done? And then I'd get drunk again and do those things. So, there isn't a story told that I cannot identify with, if not from the physical action, from the thinking process that went on. There isn't anything that any man, woman, or young person in this program has ever talked about. Perhaps I haven't done it, but I've thought about doing it. So I began to find out that I was a member of the human race. I had to be very careful. I do not feel that my sobriety is threatened. And I have to be aware of that little pitfall, too, because I might get too comfortable. You know, the booze is not cunning, baffling, and powerful. I am. And we add two more words. I don't know whether they probably do down here, because AA is pretty big, but it's pretty small. Cunning, baffling, powerful, jealous, and patient. And this thing waits. This little thing waits. I had my first year birthday, and I was walking around the backyard the next morning, and I was just feeling fabulous. Man, I got that cotton picking first year out of the way. And the little voice said, "You feel wonderful." And I talked to it, and I said, "I feel great." And it said, "Why don't you have a drink? You'll feel better." And I went in and called my sponsor. I said, "You know, I got my cake last night." He said, "Yeah." And I said, "I was walking around the front yard this morning, and a little voice talked to me." And I said, "You know what it said?" He said, "Have a drink." I said, "Yeah." I said, "What do I do now?" He said, "Start all over again one day at a time." For you people who are new, if you felt or are feeling anything like I did, that one day at a time just bugged me something proliferous. One day at a time. I said, "You mean I can't even think? You mean I have to sit like a vegetable?" Larry said, "What's the matter with the vegetable? It's got roots." The first 45 years of my childhood damn near killed me. And Larry has made the statement many times, "Webb, if you can make it, anybody can make it." Because I came to this program for 8 months prior to coming into it, drinking all the time during those 8 months. I never had a slip. I just kept drinking. I never stopped. And the first night that I went, I'd been sitting in my den at home crying and drinking and drinking and crying and feeling that something had to be done. I was aware of AA. So I got the phone book out, the Valley phone book, and I called the number, and it was the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And it was a participation meeting that night. And the guy said, "Well, the meeting's about half over," but he said, "You live pretty close. Come on down." So I took my bottle and got in the car and drove down there. Well, you know, that's a pretty horrible decision to make with those people, you know, all those drunks. And I had a few snorts to get comfortable before I went into the meeting. I opened the door, and they had a greeter in those days, and it was a fellow I'd known out in civilian life. And he said, "Dick, how are you? Come in." I thought, my God, they're waiting for me. See, I'd had destroyed ego sitting in my den, drinking and crying and just in a horrible mess. And from my house down to North Hollywood Clubhouse, my ego had come back. That's why I like to stress ego. I thought, they're waiting for me. He took me in and put me down in the front row. Why, naturally, it was me. So the chairman of the meeting, these various people got up. The lights were too bright. The people were laughing. And I was afraid to look around. Somebody might recognize me and all this sort of thing. And he finally leaned over the podium and he said, "Is there anybody else who would like to say a few words?" I had to get up and talk to him. And there are two steps up to that scaffold there. I had my back to the audience as I mounted him. And the leader looked at me, shook hands with me, a little smile. He said, "Have you had anything to drink?" Now, I've never known any alcoholic who would admit to more than two. "Oh, I've had a couple." So I said, "I've had a couple." I was cross-eyed. And he said, "Well, why don't you go back and sit down and come back when you're sober?" And I said, "Well, I just want to say," he says, "go back and sit down." I went back and I sat down and I thought, these people are not ready for me. But regardless, I will be a gentleman. I will remain here. And I did. I stayed until the meeting was over. And people came over and they were saying hello and slapped me on the back, and I thought, what a horrible group of people. I felt dirty and unclean. And I went home and I walked in the door and I put my hand up on the door jamb and I looked at my wife and I says, "My name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic." Now, in my mind, all alcoholics drank. So, as I say, I never quit. I just continued to drink. I never had a slip. I went to meetings. I'd hide my bottle wherever I could that was closest to the door outside where I could get it. And particularly in the stag meetings, by the time the meeting was over, I would be pretty well oiled, and I would say, they'd say, "Are there any questions?" I'd say, "Yeah, how do you stop drinking?" And some smart guy would always say, "You put the plug in the jug." And I said, "But you don't understand." And I said, "Anyhow, I've not done what you people have done. I haven't done this and that." And they said, "Keep drinking, you will." And I kept drinking, and I did, right down the middle, right on schedule. It's very interesting to find out after you come here, feeling different, as all of us do coming here. As time goes by, you find you're not different. Your thinking is not different. It's taken all this time. Just last week, I heard a fellow get up and talk about drinking up in a tree. Well, that's the first time that I'd met anyone in the program. But if you stay around long enough, you're going to hear your story. And I got a little jealous of him, because I wanted to be the only one that drank up in a tree. Yeah, I have a walnut tree out in my front yard, and Bill and Buck and Doris and a number of people have heard the tape. Buck and I spoke together over in Alabama some time ago. I was buying my vodka, and I'm appearing here through the courtesy of Smirnoff Vodka today. I was buying my vodka in those half-gallon bottles, and I put it in a cradle and put it up high, and they said warm vodka works faster than cold and so on. You don't need a glass. I put a nozzle on it so I could just walk by. And it goes down slower in that half-gallon jug than it does in the other. So I would drink in the house with one eye on my wife, waiting for her to say something. Give me a good excuse why that rotten broad, I'll show her. I would get comfortable drinking in the house, go out the door, around the drive and up into my walnut tree, where I had another bottle stashed. The psychiatrist asked me what I thought about when I was up in that tree. See the identification? You already know what I thought. Nobody knows where I am. And she said, "Whom did you think cared?" We get so sick and so tired and so miserable coming down that home stretch trying to hit bottom. We just know that nobody loves us, so we have to love ourselves. Complete narcissism. I thought everybody wanted to know where I was. My wife had come out of the door calling me for dinner. I'd sit up there with my toes curled around that branch, sucking on that jug. And I'd look down and think, stupid broad, she doesn't know where I am. I didn't know where I was. The thinking, ladies and gentlemen, not the act, the thinking. That sick, sick, sick entity. We who do these self-destructive things to ourselves, not realizing why in the beginning. In the beginning, I had a lot of fun drinking. When I came to AA and they told me that I was committing suicide, drinking the way that I did, I commit suicide. I've had a suicide syndrome since I was 5 years old. And I put it into action when I started to drink. All of my life I have set myself up to be hurt, to be killed, to be maimed. If they had a demolition job to do in the Army, Webb was out there number one, take that stuff and run. Always setting myself up to be hurt or killed. Thinking that death would be much more preferable to living. Because I didn't like people, I said. I hated people, I said. I couldn't stand what was going on this planet, I said. I couldn't stand me. So when I came to the program, they said, you'll have to reconstruct all of your thinking. And of course, I began to project. And they said, no, just today. Just today. You don't do those things that were hurting you. And as I told one of the fellows when he gave me my copy of the big book, I said, I can read that in an hour. He said, that's right. But he said, it'll take you the rest of your life to learn how to live it. Another thing that I have to be very aware of, my story is not very coherent, I'll grant you. I just kind of cast around. I never know what's going to come out, really. So as my sponsors have told me, get up and tell your story. Regardless of how it comes out, somebody may identify with it. These things I try to do. Which reminds me of a little story. It just popped into my mind. There's a little alcoholic walked into a restaurant and he sat down. It's apropos of nothing. And the waitress came over and she said, what'll you have? He says, bring me a whole pie. I said, a whole pie? He said, yes. He said, what kind? He said, apple. She said, how many pieces do you want it cut into? Four or six? He says, make it four. I can't eat six. As I said, apropos of nothing. My way of doing things had been wrong all of my life. I'm learning the things now that I should have learned when I was 4 or 5 years old. I heard them, but I didn't learn them. Bill and I were talking. I'm a rebel. I have to learn not to be a rebel. I have to learn to conform. I have to learn not to be critical of other people. I have to learn not to resent. Ruth spoke of so many things last night. I can get the hottest resentment in the fastest time of anybody that I know. And it doesn't do a damn thing to the person that I resent, except make me unhappy. The self-pity. All of these little things that lay in wait for us. I have to be aware all the time of who I am and what I am. My name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm also a neurotic. I went to a psychiatrist, and she said, what do you think's the matter with you, Mr. Webb? And I said, well, for openers, I think I'm psychotic, psychoneurotic, schizophrenic, psychopathic. So she gave me a catalog of all the questions that you take. I took it home with me. It took me 3 days. I tried to outthink it the first 2 days, and you can't. So I gave up, and I answered it, and I sent it back to her. In a few days, she called me to come down. And I said, well, what am I? She said, you're a neurotic. Now, you and I who have tried so hard to be psychopathic and schizophrenic and psychotic and all these, to be told that we're a garden-type neurotic is very shattering. But she did make me feel better by saying, but you alcoholics are very interesting neurotics. You know what is ever apparent to me as time goes on? The things that this program has given me that I could not buy with any amount of money. You people have restored my dignity and my self-respect, of which I had none when I came here. Never before in my life have I ever been able to get up in front of a group or an audience and to feel as nervously comfortable as I feel today and feel that I have so many friends sitting out there who are not waiting to take my inventory. And even if they do, I figure it's their problem. These things that you've given me are things that I should have learned when I was a kid. So, this could indicate, and I don't know this, but maybe this is what we were supposed to do. I can look back in my life and follow that very crooked line that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. This was the only way for me to go. It was death or insanity. So I feel that there was a reason why I went that way. Now then, the path is open to me. And I like my ears to get big when I say this. The path is open to me. The hope is here. The way to do it is here. And if I arbitrarily now take those reins back in my own hand and I go off on a tangent and I begin to drink and begin to pill around, I only thought I hurt before. Because there is hope, regardless of what any of us may think. I've heard people use excuses, well, I'm psychotic, I can't make it. Well, I'm nuts, I can't make it. I says, come down to the meeting and listen to the rest of them. The saving grace to me has been the divulgence of everything that people think about and the way they feel. As most of us, when I came here, I heard people speaking from the podium and telling these horrible, horrible stories, and I thought, oh boy, I'll never do that. Holy mackerel. And I would never get up there and talk, and I would never get up and read the fifth chapter. I would never do this. And little by little by little, I began to do all of those things because I watched other people doing it, and it didn't seem to hurt them a bit, and the other people listening to these horrible stories didn't seem to put them down. Except another newcomer like myself. Who would think, oh boy, what a stinking person that is. And he's probably talking about the same things I did. Take a good look. That's what they told me. I never took a good look. I'd lost all sense of reality long before I got here, but I wouldn't take a look. I used to chase people down Ventura Boulevard, which is the main boulevard out in San Fernando Valley, 100 miles an hour, straddling the white line with a .38 in my hand, waiting for somebody to stop me. My wife cowering down in the front of the car, you know, in front of the front seat. And isn't it strange? I'd run stop signs and the whole bit, and there was not a soul on the street. After a few miles, I'd give it up, unload the gun, she'd take it, put it away, and I'd drive back. I'd stop at all the stop signs, and there were people walking back. And I wasn't supposed to kill anyone, I wasn't supposed to hurt anyone, except me, so that I could get to this place. God has a plan for me. God has a plan for us if we will listen. I'm one drink away from a drunk. And I get to hurting sometimes emotionally so bad I just think I'll lose my mind. And I thought one time, well, Buck has heard this and Bill have. I won't drink, but I'll take a pill. Nobody will ever know. And I was sitting in the clubhouse that afternoon, and a guy came in on pills, about 3 feet off the floor. And I said, oh, nobody will know, huh? It is a simple program. We complicate it. I complicate it. I make it difficult. I tell myself that I can't stand these emotional things that happen to me. I can't stand it when I am denied what I want. And I begin to louse things up. Nobody else. And I've worked with guys who've been around, who've been in the program for a while, and then they go back to drinking. And I ask them why. I just can't make the program. Why? It's too tough. It says in our big book that people feel that they cannot. Oh, my God, I can't do all those things. You know, if I kill myself, I might have to come back and do this all over again, and ain't that a hell of a thing to think about? Like, wow. I've already had this one. There's got to be something else. These little things I am believing and seeing more and more. I've listened to what I would call at the time old-timers. And I used to say, if Bill would say, make some statement, I'd say, I can't buy that. I don't say these things anymore too much. I might not agree with him, but I listen. Because these people have done it years longer than I have done it. And it's living out there, as Clancy says, out there on the bricks, baby. How are you doing out there? Never mind in here. These are the things that I think about. How do I get along with other people? Do I act or do I react? I've been a reactor all my life. Furious. And I looked at one guy in a meeting one night and I said, I'll get drunk at him. It made a lot of sense, didn't it? I'd die, and this guy would probably say, poor Webb, he was such a nice guy, not knowing that I killed myself at him because I hated him. It's ridiculous. As long as I keep these things in front of me and ask God's guidance, and then am willing to listen to this, I don't know what turn my life is going to take. I know what turn I would like for it to take. I do not know today what is going to happen tomorrow, but I know that if I have made the effort to make my peace with my God as I understand God, and I have made a contract with my God as I understand it, I better do it. Chuck Chamberlain says, these are the steps we took, and you better took them. I try to take them. I don't do too well at it, but I do it to the best of my ability. I can always pick out the person who is not doing it right. And I found out that the people that I don't like and the people I don't think are working the program properly are the people who are doing exactly the things that I'm doing. Now that was a big eye-opener to me. That what I didn't like in another person is what I didn't like in me, but who in the hell wants to look at themselves? Look at them. I got on a plane. I was doing a series called U.S. Border Patrol. And I played a chief. And I had a badge. And I got on a plane to go down to Miami to make the last four shows of that series. And I began drinking on the plane. I drank everything the stewardess would serve me. That's coming over Texas. And what I had in my little briefcase, and in New Orleans I got off and I bought a fifth because those pints went too fast. Got back on the plane. I got two guys in conversation across the aisle with me. And I was very gregarious when I would drink. So I asked these fellows, I said, where are you from? And the one fellow said, Germany. And being a chief, I said, well, you have to have a passport. He said, no, I don't have a passport. I said, but you've got to have a passport. If you go out of the country and come back, he said, no, I don't have one. So I asked the fellow with him, I said, where do you come from? He said, around, and I knew there was something wrong with him. So I got out a pad and pencil, and I began to make notes, asking him questions, you know, and I put these notes down. Very sharp. So finally I called the stewardess, and I said, I'd like to speak to the captain, please. She said, what about? Now, I didn't tell her I was a chief. I pulled my attaché case out from under the seat, and it had that big Border Patrol insignia, blue and gold, Bureau of Immigration and Naturalization, U.S. Border Patrol. And she said, ooh, I wish I was half as smart, sober as I was brilliant when I was drinking. It hasn't worked that way. I've been very dull since I got sober. So up we go to the pilot's cabin. I conned the pilot, the co-pilot, the radio operator, and the engineer. See, I walked straight, I talked straight. The only indication was my left eye was over in the corner because I was out. But they didn't know this. They just thought I was normally cockeyed, maybe. My wife always knew when Webb was out of his skull. And the captain said, what do you want me to do? I'd taken over that plane. You don't ask a passenger what you want you to do about the plane. I said, well, when you get close enough to Miami, you call your office, to call the Border Patrol, to tell the chief to meet me at the bottom of the ramp. I got a couple of live ones back here. And he said, I'll do it, and he did. Somehow the message got garbled some way, but anyhow, a Border Patrol chief has two spies on Flight 704. The plane landed and came to a stop, and the ramp came on. I was the first one down the ramp, naturally. There was no chief at the bottom of the ramp, as I had ordered. So you know what I had to do, and I did it. I put a citizen's arrest on these two guys. I noticed there were lines of guys here and there, and there was a truck with searchlight on the back of it, and it was probing around, and I wondered, who's coming in? It was me. I was coming. So as these guys stepped off the plane, I took them by the cuffs of their coat very gently. And I said, this is a citizen's arrest. You remain here until the proper authorities arrive. Well, these were the proper authorities that were all lined up there. And they said, they asked me who I was, and I told them, I said, you stand here. And they marched us off across Miami Airport, down into the bowels of the airport, to an interrogation room. Put me in a nice, comfortable chair, these guys up on a table. And I read my notes and told my story about what had happened on this plane. These guys were sitting up there shaking, and I was very calm. I got all through with my story, reached under, pulled out my attaché case, opened it up, pulled out my jug, and loaded the vodka. Now the sergeant was looking at me. And then he saw the cocked eye, I guess, because he said, you gentlemen may go. And he said, you better go too. It was too late. They took umbrage at what I had done. It hit all the papers. I called my wife, who immediately engaged a battery of attorneys. 3 days later, we were shooting some scenes out in the Everglades, and a very personable young man, like Charles here, approached me and he said, are you Mr. Webb? And I said, yes. He said, here. I said, where have you been? It was subpoenas. $250,000 on National Airlines, $250,000 on my ex-boss, $250,000 on me, and $47,000 punitive damage. What was my reaction to all this? Why, they're stupid. It was a case of mistaken identity. Could have happened to anybody, but it didn't. It happened to me. Why? Because I was smashed. I lost all touch with reality. 3 years after coming to the program, which was 4 years after that incident happened, I had to go back down to Miami and stand trial for that little caper, clearing up the wreckage of my past. So I called my sponsor, and I said, those guys are only after money. And he said, yes. And I said, I ain't going. So he said, Richard, it says in the big book, we will be willing to make amends. I said, I'm willing. I ain't going. I could see myself breaking coral down in St. Augustine with a striped suit on. But I went. on National Airlines. I sat very quietly, didn't arrest a soul. And when I stepped off the plane, they had pulled that whole case out of the files again. Of course, it was a big thing, and the photographers were there and all of this stuff. The trial was 4 days long. There was a 7-man jury. And for the first time in my life, I sat on the stand in public with a microphone so you could hear a person breathe. And I told the truth. And I kept saying, God, you know what's going on down here? The judge was sitting up at the bench with his hands like this, and every once in a while he'd look at me. Because I admitted that I lied in my depositions, my statements, and the man says, it says here that you took a couple of drinks. And I said I had drunk 2/5 at that time. I perjured myself, I did the whole schmear, and the jury was sitting there looking at me. It isn't easy to do these things. So, I was 2.5 hours on the stand, and the jury was out 2.5 hours. And I thought, there goes, hoo-hoo, St. Augustine, everything. They came back in. Everybody got off with a general charge of $250,000, and the judge read, Mr. Webb, guilty on the punitive damage charge. And I thought, see, I tried to tell the truth and do right, and here they're going to get me. Each one of the plaintiffs got $1 apiece. Because they lied on the stand, and I didn't. And their attorney got so upset trying to hook me that he got all confused. And my attorney, when he went over to give his little last address to the jury, all he did was walk over to him and say, ladies and gentlemen, could you have done what Mr. Webb did? I don't think I could. Then he went back and sat down, and I said, God, he's blown the whole thing. I expected some table pounding and thumping and waving of arms, you know, and nothing. But the judge called me back in his chambers after it was over, and he said, Mr. Webb, he said, whatever you're doing, keep on doing it. He said, you had that plaintiff's attorney so confused. He said, they come here knowing you're going to lie, not prepared for the truth. He said, you get them all upset. He said, your own attorney came in to protect you from your own lies, and you left him speechless. He said, you're the 4th member of Alcoholics Anonymous I've had before my bench. As a defendant, he said, you're usually defendants. And he said, you people, when you're practicing your program, you can't be beat. And that reminded me of the story of the little guy who was around the clubhouse. He was new in the program for about 6 months, and all of a sudden he disappeared. Nobody saw him. About 2 years later, back he came, and they said, Harry, where have you been? He said, well, you know, when I came in the program, you said, turn my problems over to God. I said, yeah. He said, he must have turned them over to the sheriff, because I just got out. When I came to the program, I thought, well, because I'd come from family, both of my grandfathers were ministers, Hardshell Baptist and Hardshell Southern Methodist, and I went to a Bible school. And I thought, I don't know whether I'll be able to survive, because they're going to begin shoving religion down my throat again. And I was amazed to hear God as you understand God. And a man said, how do you pray? Another fellow said, do you think about praying? He said, oh, yeah. He said, I'm sure God understands. And this became very, very comfortable to me. Because I wasn't going to be hit with all this hellfire and damnation and going to burn and all this. I've been burning all my life. God, as I understand God, a power, a force. A fellow asked me one time, he said, do you believe in God? I said, yes. He said, why? I said, because it makes me comfortable. That's about as nitty-gritty as I could get. You try not thinking of God for 5 minutes, and you'll begin to itch. I've itched. I've tried both. They said, do not try to analyze this program. Don't be too smart. Utilize what you have here. Talk to the old-timers, the people who've been around for many, many years. They have lived through what you yet have to live through. Find out how they did it. Slow down, slow down. Big saying in our clubhouse is there, shut up, sit down, and listen. And just about at that range. There's nothing easy, there's nothing pussyfoot about our clubhouse. And we have many people come into the program, stay a few months, and say, I can't stand this place, and they go to other meetings. I was one of them. And after 2 years, I got hold of a new client, as I call them, in the middle of the day, and I thought, what in the world am I going to do with this guy? North Hollywood Clubhouse. And I took him back to the clubhouse, and the fellow said, hi, Dick, how are you? And they grabbed this guy and set him down and began talking, and I thought, my, how they have changed. They hadn't changed a bit. I had. I had to do these things to save myself. People began to look different to me. The plateaus that I hit in the first 5 years are something horrible. At 4 years in the program, I went into an emotional depression where it was just loud and clear to me that there was no meaning to my life. There was nothing for me. It was like a vast plateau without even a blade of grass on it. So one night I ground up 70 aspirin. I'd heard that aspirin would kill you if you took enough of them. And I ladled those ground up 70 aspirin down. I went out and I got my little dog and took her in the bedroom, put her on the bed, and I knelt down and I said, God, I'll see you soon. I got up and went to bed. You know I damn near died. I threw up purple, blue, black, orange. And there I was again in the morning, wound around the thunder mug, just like I'd been when I was drinking. God help me. Guy said, you ever pray? Sure. God help me. They took me to the emergency hospital. Doctor said, what did you take? And I told him. He said, oh, what a jerk. I said, Doc, what is that all kinds of foam I'm throwing up? He says, your liver. So he said, come back in a couple of months and I'll see what kind of damage you've done to it. He said, you've blown it. So in about 4 months, I did go back over to him. And he asked me how I felt. And he went right for the liver and checked me all over. And he says, Mr. Webb, he said, physically there isn't a damn thing wrong with you. But, Mr. Webb, I said, yeah, I know. This is what I have to live with. Nobody can do it for me. I have to do it myself. But I'm not alone. You know, I don't own a thing on this planet. Not one single solitary thing except my own soul, and that belongs to God. This leaves me pretty naked. I'm searching for the truth. We're all searching for the truth. Regardless of how we get there, by many, many routes, if we'll look, try not to hurt another. I never knew anything about love. As Ruth said last night. I still don't know too much about it. But I am learning consideration. Let the other person up. Take my inventory, not theirs. And I don't do that all the time. I take inventories hourly on other people. And it doesn't hurt them a bit, it hurts me. But the longer I'm in this program, the more I try to work it, the more aware that I become of these things that I do that I should not do because they hurt me. I have asked Blake many times when I am all emotionally upset, how bad do I have to hurt? He throws it back to me and he says, how bad do you want to hurt? That's right back in your own lap, baby. How bad do I want to hurt? If I stop doing those things, I don't have to hurt. But if I want to hold on to a resentment or self-pity, any of those things that are so bad for us. Yes, I'm different. I cannot afford the luxury of self-pity and resentment and fear and hate and rage that the non-alcoholic can. Because sooner or later, begins to turn. Stinking thinking, they call it. Leads to drinking. I use booze as a medicine. And finally the tail was wagging the dog and I didn't know what was the matter with me. I don't have to do those things anymore unless I want to. Now that throws it back in my lap again. Here's the way to go. No, I won't go that way. All right. I'm going to have to suffer for it. And if I die in an alcoholic convulsion, or I get put away for life, I'll probably have to come back and do it all over again. And that just scares the hell out of me, thinking about having to come back, do it all over again. Yeah, I can see it does somebody else, too. If you're new here, I mean relatively new, real new, you probably won't hear too much. But in every meeting that you go to, they do say, please get the feeling of the hope that these people have. Look around you. There's enough power in this room if we were all drunk at the same time to set off the atomic bomb. You know, it's very interesting, too, and I like to say this for myself. It has been proven to their satisfaction by psychiatry that the average alcoholic is above average mentality. I like to remind myself of this every once in a while. Makes me feel better. Regardless of how much education or anything we've had, and as one man told Bill, God only knows what I would have been if I hadn't been an alcoholic. At 5 years in the program, and up to that time, I had always said in any meeting that I had gone to or spoken at, that I was one of the greatest escape artists that I ever knew. Loved to escape. I had extensive dental surgery done. And my daughter, who's a nurse, was out here. And the doctor gave her some pills, and he said, tomorrow morning he may have some pain, and if he does, give him one of the pills. So in the morning I had pain, she gave me a pill, and all of a sudden, I said, Patty, what are those? She said, Percodan. And I said, well, what's Percodan? She said, like, wow, Dad. And I said, don't give me no more wow. You know what happens? You come in this program, you don't drink, you don't take pills, you begin to reconstruct your personality, you begin to think. And all of a sudden, unbeknownst to you, your mind gets clear and you begin to enjoy a clear mind. And for 5 years, I had said, I'm the great escape artist. And at that moment, I found out that I no longer wished to escape. The suicide thing, the self-destructive thing had left me, and I didn't even want my mind to be okay. So I hurt emotionally, and I'll shake. But my mind's clear. I want to be able to think through that thing. And they told me when I came here, think through the drunk. And they also told me, if you can't remember your last drunk, you ain't had it. Try that on for size. I've had non-alcoholics say, what the hell do you people, you know, pull out all these horrible stories for? That's exactly why we do it. And to get other people to identify with the kind of thinking that we had. I don't ever want to forget my last drunk. I might forget to remember. And sooner or later, I'm going to reach for something. And then back I go, and if I thought I had trouble then, I don't know nothing. I've seen it work. I've seen these guys go down the drain. And not too many of those people who have any appreciable length of time in the program are alcoholics. They're there in that Saugus facility only for alcohol. And we used to go out there and speak, and there'd be maybe 100, 125 guys come to the meeting out of the 15 to 1800. So then everybody began pointing fingers at each other out there in the city hall, and they all got scared, and the sheriff thought, well, I better get something going here. So he called AA and he said, we will march them in if you will bring speakers out. Well, I was the first speaker that went out there. And here were 450 guys sitting there, mad. And I was sitting there looking at them. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to say? They didn't want to be there. And I got up and I identified myself. I said, my name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic. There was complete silence. I sat. And I went dry. I just went blank. And a little voice seemed to speak to me, and it said, go forth without fear. And I said, fellas, a little voice just spoke to me. I said, you don't want to be here, and I'm scared. But I said, the little voice told me to go forth without fear. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. And I said, if any of you identify. And then I started off by telling them that how I sat in my front room one night, up at the head of the room in my favorite shooting chair, and my agent was sitting about 20 feet across the room from me, and I had a .357 Magnum in my hand, and from the hip, I just, boom, and pulled off a shot at him. He was about half bagged. He looked at me and says, it cracks when it goes by. The bullet hole is still in the frame of the window. I replaced the window. Left the bullet hole there. What was the thinking? Now, most any normal person would have said, you know, thought, oh, my God, what I've almost done. I didn't. I looked at him and I thought, you jerk, next time I'll aim. Because I hated myself so bad that I'd shoot another human being. I was antisocial. You dig? You've been there? I don't have those feelings today. The hell I don't. Have you ever driven down a street and some wiseacre with a little curl of their lip will walk out in the street and look at you, and you look around to see who's around, see if you might be able to get them before anybody comes out? And then back over them in case they're still wiggling. I still have all the same feelings. They told me, you'll have to get rid of all your defects of character. And I said, oh, see you around, Dad. But they then qualified it by saying, if you can't get rid of them, learn to live with them. There are many things that maybe I may be able to get rid of as time goes by. And those that I can't get rid of, I have to be aware that they're there and not let them sneak up and bite me when I'm not looking. I know they're there. Okay, this is one of the things I have to live with. If I can do it, as my sponsor said, anybody can do it. You people have given me my life. This program to me is life itself. They told me when I came here, they said, please, draw the line. Don't get your religion mixed up with AA. Because I had a tendency to do that, because I'd been to a Bible school. I thought I should carry the Bible when I went into meetings. But more of us have been returned to our faith after we came to AA. There are two gentlemen here today who are members of the cloth. They know that if they can't do anything about it, recommend that the person comes here. If anything can help here, chances are they will get those people back. Because we had one member out on the coast, and he began to bear very heavily on Jesus Christ and the blood of Christ in meetings. Somebody put their hand up one day in a meeting about half his size. And we get pretty rough in some of our meetings out there. I imagine you do here, too. And they said, yes, first podium. Got up and he says, with this Jesus Christ thing, he says, what about this little Jewish bastard sitting next to me? He ain't got a chance, huh? You know he's right. If this program is practiced in 90 countries, over 90 countries around the globe, this would pretty well indicate that over 90 countries around the globe do not go the Jesus Christ route that we do over here. This program lets you off the hook in every possible manner and direction. And it says in the book, it is suggested, and it also says on the first page, I think it is in the preface, in italics, after they caught you with that suggested thing, this is precisely how we did it. And when I went to my first meetings, I thought I heard a guy read one night, and he probably did, the first line of the fifth chapter. Rarely have we seen a person go to jail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I thought I heard a gal read one night, sought through prayer and medication to improve our conscious contact. Did you hear that one, Ruth? The capper to it was, you know, these little Freudian things come out. The guy was reading along, he says, half-assed measures availed us nothing. Well, they don't. Either you do it or you don't do it. Go over to the alcoholic ward. This young lady here who's a nurse in the alcoholic ward here. She works for the alcoholics. If you think you're in danger of forgetting your last drunk, go over and look at her ward. I go down to County General every once in a while. Go up to 6th floor. They got so many of them down there, they've got them in the halls. They're walking around half-dressed, half-naked, livers blown. And they got gurneys outside, two double doors, and it says M-O-R-G-U-E, and those doors are moving all the time. The doctors come by and take a look, check the guy, say, bang. They roll. I said, what happens to them in there? He says, they roll them across the floor, dump them down a chute, and hang them up down in the meat room. They don't know who they are or where they came from. I like to go down and look once in a while, just in case I should forget. Sure, I can stand and say, well, I would never do that. That could never happen to me. Yeah? Half-assed measures avail us nothing. It is incomprehensible to me, really, that I can stand here before you and feel as comfortable in trying to give back to you what you have given to me. Because I got it right here. And when I would walk on a sound stage all during my entire career before I came to AA, I was scared to death. And now, when I get a part to do, as I approach the stage to go in to go to work, I just stop for a moment and I say, thank you, God. You wouldn't have given this to me if I couldn't do it. And I can go in now, and I've had directors say to me, Webb, I've known you for 25 years, and I've never seen you do work like you're doing now. And I told one fellow who knew my story, I said, I have a higher director. And he says, I'm heaven. These things will happen to us, even if we don't think they will happen to us, if we will do these things to the best of our individual abilities. And it does help to make this program if you don't drink or don't take pills. I've been told. I had 8 months of drinking prior to coming in. And that was my last 8 months. June 12, 1960 was my last drink. And I said, God willing, it'll be my last drink. And my sponsor looked at me and said, God's willing, are you willing? Always back in my lap. And he is very strong on this little thing that I like very much. Baby, there ain't no place to hide. There ain't no place to hide. I hide in this program. But this means that I'm out on the firing line. Because I'm doing 12-step work. I'm thinking about someone else. AA to me, and I speak for no one else. AA is my religion at this point. This has saved my life and my sanity, has given me a way to go. My God is a loving God now. It's not the God of my youth in the Old Testament. And I'm comfortable. And I try to let other people do their way. Because I have a tendency to say, do it my way. Because that's how my sponsor brought me up. Doing it his way. Trying to. But he was right, and I've always been so wrong. I don't know, I've talked way old, Michael. I do want to thank you. This has been some kind of a breakthrough today for me. I've never spoken quite so long. I have never felt so comfortable in speaking. I have never had such a good time, particularly as we did last night, a great number of us. We sat around talking about various and different things. At a table over at the dance. On February the 12th, a friend of mine and I are supposed to start a picture over right outside of Dallas. We'll be there for approximately 3 weeks. We're going to be staying at the Marriott Hotel. Now, we may not be in during the day. But if any of you are over in Dallas after the 12th of February, and you'd like to give us a call or leave a number or something, I might add the other guys in the program, too. Everyone who is anyone is in AA. Give us a call. We might possibly, unless this producer makes us work all day and all night both, be able to return it or meet you or go to a meeting or sit down for a cup of coffee or something. But I never have to be alone anymore. Wherever I go, I can always find a friend. Maybe I've never met them before. But I walk in, my name is Dick Webb, I'm an alcoholic. Sit down, Dick, what do you have? Now I'm getting hooked on coffee. But I want to thank you very, very much for allowing me this opportunity to progress myself in trying to give back to you what you have given me. And for you newcomers, this is the way that our program works. By giving it away, I'm allowed to keep it. In fact, I gain more by trying to give it away. This is a program of surrender and you'll win. This is difficult for us to do. But you try it, and if I can make it, anybody can make it. If you're in California, you can't get hold of us any other way, the San Fernando Central Office or the Los Angeles Central Office will know where I can be reached. And we have 113 meetings a week in the Valley area, 600 meetings a week in the L.A. area. So it's big business out there. And none of them have been a nicer group than you people here have. And I want to leave you with these little words from one of the end of one of the chapters in our book. We'll see each other again as we trudge the road to happy destiny. We ain't gonna fly, we ain't gonna skate, nor skip, nor jump. We're gonna trudge it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. They don't always stand.
They don't always what?
They don't always stand.
They were just tired of sitting
there. The reason I don't say very much about myself is that it's somewhat embarrassing at meetings like this. I don't have any funny stories to tell. I was one of the sniveling drinkers that went home and took it out on my family. But I understood what Dick was talking about. I understood the way he felt. Now, leaving out the gun shooting and the tree sitting, if you understood what was going on inside, you're in the right place. The best advice he gave, in my opinion, came right at the first for the new people. Stick with the winners. There are many here who have no problem with drinking, other than the visitors. They came with us, and they're called Al-Anons. And we are so very grateful that they stuck around long enough that we could begin getting well. And maybe return just a little bit of what we owe. There's another group associated with us called Al-Anon. It's not an auxiliary. They're there for another purpose. They're there to recover from the family illness that we caused by our drinking. The teenage youngsters have an organization called Alateen, which is for the same reason, and I mentioned them sometime before. And we're very grateful that not only men drink, because the women add a lot to our group, and they add a lot to the Al-Anon group, and they've gotten together. They have cake and coffee in the back room, which they're going to serve after the meeting is over. So we'll have something to hold as we stand around and visit, because we stand around and visit whether there were cake or coffee or not. We'd like very much for the visitors to join us in this. The time has come for my sponsors to tell me what I have forgotten. Sudie? Paul? Marshall? Must be getting better. Well, now it can be told. I know many of you have been sitting there wondering what in the world Bill Masterson's doing, Bill M. is doing sitting up here. The committee didn't find it necessary to find a replacement speaker, but they sent him as backup for me. Our customary method of closing our meetings is to stand and repeat in unison the Lord's Prayer. Bill, would you lead us?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.